So sad.
Don't be sad, DT.
So sad.
Don't be sad. America's back, baby.
You're
America's
right.
back.
I'm done being sad.
Mr. Speaker.
You're at the intersection of business and politics. This is the 14th and G podcast from Melman Consulting. Now, here's our host, Dean Hinkson.
Thank you for sending your podcast out to 14th and G. I am your host, Dean Hinkson. It's just a little over 2 weeks since Election Day and the aftershocks of a political earthquake. Well, they're still coming at regular intervals, and I'm forecasting more aftershocks and maybe more earthquakes. We're in for one hell of a ride, and so I'm glad to have my first buddies along for that ride. They're like Elon and Vivek to me. Republican Bruce Melman, Democrat David Thomas. Let's see if we can cover 2024 in 24 minutes.
Who's Elon?
Take your pick, boys.
I'm already so depressed, Dean. And now you can bear me to Vivek Ramaswamy.
I don't want you to be depressed.
It's been a rough 2 weeks.
On the way up to the 14th and G Worldwide Studios this morning, I paused on the landing and I gazed up at the beautiful rendering of our 16th president by the artist Ghetto. And I read again those ever poignant words from his second inaugural, which I'll paraphrase to you, DT. With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us strive to finish the work we are in, to do all which we may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves. That's my sentiment to you.
I love it. I'm already feeling better. I'm just going to forget that the incoming president also said, I am your retribution, which maybe that got knocked out of Lincoln's first draft in the Gettysburg Address. I'm not sure.
Well, we won't go into all the analogies we can draw from Reconstruction, but let's do touch briefly on what happened, because we did have a political earthquake. Everybody knows the sort of the high level, but We're getting more granular data on ballots, on how the vote went. The counting is almost finished as soon as California's done. maybe by Thanksgiving. Bruce, what happened on election night as you see it?
As I see it, Harris lost for three reasons and Trump won for three reasons. And I have slides about this, as you may not be surprised. So why'd she lose? Number one, incumbency burden. Incumbents around the world have been losing. Three-quarters of the country think we're on the wrong track. It's, you know, you pick the wrong year to stop sniffing glue. You pick the wrong year to be the incumbent vice president. Number two, the Biden burden. She was the vice president for an administration, top of the ticket, that is negative 58% job approval, disapproval. It's you needed a fresher face. They didn't have one. Number three, several own goals. Not coming up with anything top of mind as to how she would differentiate herself from a very unpopular incumbent president. Was a missed opportunity. Running on joy or on vibes reminded me of that great Aaron Burr advice to Alexander Hamilton. Talk less, smile more. Don't let them know what you're against or what you're for. Didn't work for Burr. Didn't work for Harris.
He didn't say duck.
No. He didn't say joy. By contrast, you know, with Trump, he led on the top issues. And as Gallup tells us, if you lead on the top issue, you always win. It was the economy, stupid, again. Number two was immigration. Trump was seen as better on both of those. He led on the top attributes. What voters said in the exit polls they wanted, number one, ability to lead, where Trump was two out of three of the voters who said that was their top attribute. For those who wanted somebody who could bring needed change, Trump was three out of four. Now, for those who wanted good judgment, Harris was four out of five, but that was third down on the attribute list, so it didn't help her. Finally, he led on zeitgeist. You know, the Democrats' theory of the last decade was going to be the theory again that Trump, in what he's said and what he's done, would have offended too many women, too many Latinos, too many African Americans. They envisioned this as round number six in identity politics, and it turned out it's a class warfare. She brought an identity politics knife to a class warfare gunfight.
I can't disagree with anything that Bruce says here. We've spent a lot of time talking about this over the past 2 weeks here. It reminds me of when I got my start 30 years ago, and James Carville famously said, "It's the economy, stupid." And people
was he talking to you? Were you the stupid to whom he was speaking? We never knew that.
I might have been, but I think that bodes true. To me, the you know, when people are feeling uncertain about the economy, even if we've had this soft landing, clearly that's not being felt around the country, and that makes a difference. And I also think people are just exhausted. After the past 10 years we've had, everybody has a right to feel a little exhausted. That said, what I would encourage Dems and also warn Republicans about here is you hear a lot once again about the red wave, a Republican mandate, a permanent Republican majority. We've heard those words before, and I just don't think it's true. The country is still very equally divided. At the end of the day, when all the votes are counted, it's going to be about 1% difference in the popular vote. The Senate is going to have 53 votes to 47. That's actually a pretty sizable majority compared to what we've dealt with in the past couple of years. But they are going to have probably a bigger majority than the House will have, where it could just be two seats going either way. So, you know, in my advice to my Democratic friends here in town, I've been reminding them, like, keep your chin up. The chance of this majority lasting more than 2 years is slim. The House of Representatives is probably going to flip. How many elections, Bruce, have we had that have been changed in a row?
Six in a row, nine of the last 10.
Nine of the last 10. And for this, and since the year 2000, how many?
11 out of 13.
11 out of 13 elections have been changed elections where the Senate, the House, or the White House flipped. Is this going to, you know, Donald Trump better come out of the gates quickly here because he ain't going to have Congress.
He is coming out of the gates quickly. I think Republicans will, look, the next 18 months are going to be all about what this administration can get done with the Congress that it has. At some point, Republicans will ask themselves, is the Trump effect transferable to anyone else? And we look at the results of this election. I am, you know, even in states where Republicans were able to flip the Senate seat, incumbents like John Tester in Montana, Sherrod Brown in Ohio, the number of split ticket voters who voted Trump and either didn't vote for the Republican down ballot or voted for the Democrat incumbent, and in states where Trump won and Republicans did not pick up that Senate seat in Arizona, in Nevada, I think are pretty telling. And the other thing I think is really remarkable, we're seeing some of the ballot data come back. It really looks like Donald Trump threaded the needle on abortion. The number of voters who voted in favor of ballot measures for the pro-choice side and also voted for Donald Trump for president are pretty remarkable. And I think we're going to see that. As one of the big takeaways from this election.
You certainly saw him meaningfully do all he could to distance himself from the Dobbs decision. And for that matter, his nominee for HHS, the most important government position on these issues, is staunchly pro-choice.
A lot of people took him at his word that this is no longer a federal issue and it's back to the states to decide. So we'll see.
It is kind of remarkable, though, that we haven't seen split-ticket voting. Really, it almost disappeared prior to this election.
While you're 1,000% right, Dean, we saw more split ticket outcomes and certainly more split ticket voters than we've seen in many of the recent past elections. The outcome of the Senate that's entering in 2025 will have 47 out of 50 states with two Republicans or two Democrats, and only three out of the 50 states will have one Democrat, one Republican: Maine, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. That is not only a modern low. We'd have to go back to people wearing powdered wigs, I think, to find such a small percentage of the total Senate divided. And that we've seen this at the state legislatures as well, where there's still 38 states that are entirely run by Republicans or entirely run by Democrats. You got red states and blue states, and purple is an endangered species.
And I think the big question is, and we need to get to what's coming up here in the lame duck, but you know, we've talked a lot about, for a couple of cycles now, we've talked about political and party realignment. This is what realignment looks like. Now, how durable is the Trump coalition in elections to come? I don't think we know. But college, non-educated men in particular went enormously for Trump, particularly at the 18 to 29-year-old level. That is a realignment of party coalitions, and that's going to have implications for the policy going forward.
Yeah, no. So are we at a realignment? Is this a cult of personality that can outlive Donald Trump? Only time will tell there. But I think going back to the point that we discussed earlier, change elections happen every 2 years. People don't like the party in power, and the chances of the guys in charge getting voted out 2 years now pretty high.
Well, if you thought the 118th Congress was nuts, the 119th Congress is about to say, "Hold my beer and watch this." But we're going to dispose of the 118th Congress here over the next month. I think the tent poles of what this Congress is going to wrap up with are pretty well set. FY25 funding. Going to get an extension on the Farm Bill. The National Defense Authorization Act is going to get done. And then we've got a big disaster relief bill in the works, $100 billion request from the Biden White House for the hurricanes, for the bridge collapse in Baltimore. Can they get anything else done? You know, there's a lot of talk about AI and some of these other issues that might make the train as it leaves the station.
Yes, that. And what can they get done? Judges, Senator Schumer is going to keep the session going as long as he possibly can to pass those few remaining lifetime appointments there to the bench before he has to give up the majority. So, can they do anything beyond that? That seems like a tough putt. I always take the under in things getting done in a lame duck. I think it's particularly when you have a new presidency, the Senate majority changing. You've got members. I was up there yesterday who are now packing up their offices because they are either retiring or they lost. They're about to be working out of the cafeteria in the Rayburn building. That gets pretty hard to whip and to get things done when you're working next to the Ann Pizza down there. So I don't think too much more gets done in December here. It's been a pretty slow 2 weeks here in town, up on the Hill here. We've had leadership elections. We've sort of got that figured out for the next Congress here. But, can they get things done beyond appropriations, NDAA, and those a few other issues? I don't think so.
I was in the Rayburn building yesterday. Half the cafeteria is partitioned off with a sign outside that says, "Departing Member Center," which sounds like something out of Beetlejuice.
or a post-hurricane. Like refugees.
You're not in the next Congress. You get a folding table in the cafeteria. It's the realities of congressional service can sometimes be brutal.
Boy, ain't that the truth. President is sending out tweets from Mar-a-Lago at a rapid rate announcing his cabinet choices. Those are, their meetings are beginning up. I understand that J.D. Vance is personally escorting Matt Gaetz and Pete Hegseth around. That's a trio right there to go meet with senators. Look, we are looking at a doozy of a fight here on the cabinet here. There are some that I would put in the more traditional pick category. You look at Marco Rubio at the State Department is clearly somebody who is qualified to lead the State Department, and you've got others that are so out in left field.
Team of rivals. There you
rivals.
Go.
Rivals.
Hey, look, this these guys.
Band
this,
of dopes. I don't know.
If you listen to, if you listen to the sort of the conservative zeitgeist out there on podcasts and others, this is revolution. And we've seen administrations come in, I don't think we've seen an administration come in with this sort of a head of steam to really dig in at a granular level and figure out how to gain control of the executive branch, the agencies, the commissions, the boards. They are digging in things like civil service reform, returning the power of impoundment to the president to turn, which he can essentially turn off spigots of money.
Line item veto, basically,
which is a power the president had before 1974.
Yeah, the advice that we've been giving the most to clients trying to prepare is to recognize this is not year one again. It's year five. Trump 2.0 will be very different than 1.0. Anybody, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, Donald Trump, the first time you start as president, you don't understand the full powers of the office. You don't understand how to get things done. You stumble. You make mistakes. You pick people who you regret picking, Rex Tillerson. He's had 4 years to stew on, to think about, to go through the lessons, the learnings, and to prepare. They're going to come out. They're already clear. They're going to come out hotter, faster, harder than we've seen anybody come. They got a trifecta, which nobody has had in their second term when they've been consecutive. So every indicator points. You know, last time he figured out he likes tariffs. He loves tariffs. You mentioned on civil service reform, it kind of, Schedule F was an end of the fourth year. Finding, it was the start of the next year. Last time, build a wall. This time, mass deportation. 2.0 is going to be a world different than 1.0. And anybody who thinks, as we all did in 2017, you kind of got time to get in shape for the run, this is not a marathon again at the start. This is a sprint.
And add to that, Bruce, look, not only has Trump himself, you know, been out there in the wilderness for 4 years, he's had an administration in exile. And Project 2025, Heritage Foundation, I think those are red herrings. Look at the America First Policy Institute, AFP, AmericaFirstPolicy.org, I think it is. There is a very heavily articulated agenda, policy background and support, and people that were in the first Trump administration who have been out there putting this plan together. And I think that's one of the reasons you're seeing these picks come out so fast and furious very early on.
But I think our first big challenge, and boy, I wonder if Senator Thune is regretting winning the majority leader's race. He may call up Cornyn and say, you know, I'm having second thoughts. He's got to get these nominees through the Senate. Now, what has he got going for him? He's got 54 votes. That is a landslide as compared to the past few times we've done. No, well, he can lose four.
50, he can lose four because he's right.
He can lose four because he's got 50 Vance.
With Vance
so
breaking
he
ties.
He can lose four. That's a lot to lose here. You remember all the challenges that...
He can't lose four. If he loses four, he's got 49. He can lose three and Vance breaks the tie.
Right.
Oh, right.
So
right,
if he
Bruce.
Loses four, they don't
correct.
Go. It was my understanding there would be no math. Why I'm not the whip. But I would, you know, but Thune here has a real challenge here because all of these folks are not getting through. If we did a private poll of whether Matt Gaetz should be the attorney general, I'm not sure he would get any votes in the United States Senate here, but they aren't private votes. They are public. The president is leaning in on this. He sent his vice president to push for this. And at some point, they're going to count and they're either going to have the votes or they're not. Will some of these folks get through? Yes. Are all of them getting through? Absolutely not. And how does the president respond? He's already said he wants recess appointments. He may force the Senate or the Congress into adjournment so they can do recess appointments. Recess appointments have basically disappeared over the past few years here by the Congress, House and Senate coming in, even if it is a pro forma session, to prevent those longer adjournments. We'll see here, but clearly Trump is itching for a fight here. Maybe he's going to walk away from Hegseth, Gaetz, RFK, and Tulsi Gabbard. I don't think so. No. It feels like he wants to fight.
People need to put away their three-dimensional chess sort of explanations for these nominations. It's very simple. Trump wants these nominees. He will fight for these nominees. And I would say you're absolutely right, DT. No one the hardest job in Washington over the next 2 years is going to be Senate Majority Leader. It's going to be enormously challenging. It's going to be a lot to navigate. And I'll say, if we get to the point, right now these are rhetorical, I think, threats. But, if we get to the point where we're talking about Article 1, Section 6, Article 2, Section 3 of the Constitution and the power of the president to adjourn the Congress and make recess appointments, which is going to end up in the courts, that is going to be a failure. If we get to that point, the object here is to navigate this over the next 2 years so that we don't reach that point and we can and the Senate can consider these nominees under some form of regular
order.
Good
luck with that. But we've another thing that we've been advising businesses that people need to remember is when you think about, you know, to your point, or people think, is he playing 3D chess? Is the whole, you put Gaetz out there as the sacrificial lamb so that you can get in Hegseth and others. People forget the Godzilla theory of Donald Trump. When they were trying to take out Godzilla, you hit him with nukes and the beast gets stronger.
Right.
So all of the things that would have felled any political person in our lifetimes and maybe American history, you know, saying Mexicans are rapists, McCain's not a hero, Access Hollywood, there's a long list. Somehow he is at the moment stronger than he's ever been despite cats and dogs and all these other things. Normally, if you put up a nominee and the nominee goes down, you're weakened as a president. Donald Trump puts up a nominee, and to DT's point, Republican senators say, look, Gaetz is both, you know, for character and experience reasons, not appropriate as attorney general. Trump just got stronger because now, do you also want to go after Hegseth and Tulsi Gabbard and others? And so I think his strategy here is he'd love Gates as his attorney general. And if he can't get him, he believes he has political capital added to his bank account. That's just never been the way a failed nominee has been before. Godzilla theory.
Yeah, it's complete force of personality. Let's just we're getting lots of questions here in the last couple of minutes, just sort of prognosticating, thinking of a guy like Howard Lutnick as Commerce Secretary. What we know about some of these other folks that are filling in Trump's administration. What are the prospects for trade and tariffs? What are the prospects for the tech agenda in the next Congress coming out of this administration? Any indications just from the personnel that we know so far?
Look, here's what we know is coming right out the gate here. First, taxes and using the reconciliation process up on the Hill to get that done. That is coming here. What we don't know is who's going to be the sort of the chief negotiator on behalf of the president here. In the last Trump administration, it was sort of Steve Mnuchin over at Treasury. He became a trusted partner to Democrats on the Hill, which remarkable. Like who would have thunk?
Yeah. So on tariffs, you know, there are a few people we don't. Who's USTR? Who's at Treasury? We know it doesn't matter who you put in those roles. Clearly, the bias of the president is that tariffs are the most beautiful word in the English language. They're going to come in believing tariffs stop wars, offset deficits, increase economic growth. I'm expecting that they're going to throw in a congressional tariff measure into the reconciliation pot as a revenue raiser, which would be the first time Congress voted to raise tariffs since Smoot-Hawley. On tech, you know, Lutnick doesn't tell me anything yet. He's a Wall Street guy. I don't know where he stands on tech. The most important named person to date is Brendan Carr, an FCC commissioner who's about to become the FCC chairman. Very smart, very capable. As best I can tell, the tech portfolio may be one of the areas that J.D. Vance and his operation lead on. He is a lot more populist on questions like antitrust. He's anti-big tech, but very pro-small tech. So if I'm Google, I'm worried. If I am a venture-backed player, I am excited. Certainly crypto, the president and the vice president-elect have been very supportive. I think there's a lot of players. People are policy. A lot of players in tech. We have to watch and see who lands where. Kratsios last time at OSTP paid a bigger role than OSTP typically plays. But who's at antitrust? Who's at FTC? Who's at SEC? Who's at NTIA?
So much more to come. We've got personnel to fill out. We've got this reconciliation process that's going to start day one probably of the new Congress when they're sworn in on January 3rd. Congressional Review Act, regulatory rollbacks. We'll be back to cover it all here on 14th and G with my good friend, Republican Bruce Melman, Democrat David Thomas. Thanks for joining me on 14th and G.
Happy holidays.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast brought to you by the lobbying firm of Melman Consulting. For more, just type 14th and G podcast into your favorite search engine or look for 14th and G wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe.
Beam me up, Mr. Speaker.